My pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Keith D. from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. Most important thing that I can say is I've not taken a drink of alcohol, nor have I used any kind of narcotic since May 11, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. Thank Kim for inviting me to participate, and it's always a pleasure to participate in my recovery, and everybody for being here. Stephanie, great 10-minute talk. That fires me up. I always feel good when people have enthusiasm. The new, or relatively new people here, it's hard to imagine, I'm sure, or if you're having trouble with Alcoholics Anonymous, that one could have enthusiasm. I have enthusiasm. I have enthusiasm about life. I'm over 31 years sober, and I'm 67 years old. Saturday, I will be having a 45th wedding anniversary with my wife, and I have a daughter, and she loves me and has forgiven me, and I have two granddaughters who love me, and know not the way I treated their mother or their grandmother. And I woke up this morning, and I was excited about this day. My friend Chris came out from California and is a house guest here. Sue and I have a house here in Las Vegas. So when we're in Las Vegas, we are residents of Las Vegas. And that's a good feeling. I like Las Vegas. Las Vegas has a special interest to me. And I really like that. I like the AA in Las Vegas. And Sue likes the Al-Anon here. And I woke up this morning. We went to the early morning meeting at the central office and talked to newcomers, and there was alcoholics there, and we went, took care of some business, gathered up with several other alcoholics and occupied our space this morning and went home, got some rest, got something to eat, went over to Richard Potter's house, and 50 alcoholics came over there. My wife went shopping and got all these bags of lettuce and all kinds of food and stuff, and got some beans and potatoes, and they had steaks, and a bunch of guys came over there and devoured it, just mowed it down like they were supposed to. You know, it was just great. My wife called up 2 or 3 Al-Anon and said, "You can't believe it. All these people are telling me how good it tasted, you know." And guys cooked steaks. And I like the buzz. I like the feeling of that. There's a good feeling that. There's a good enjoyment of that. It's a good song. A song isn't a song until you sing it, and you have to get in tune with that. And if you're new or relatively new, if you're sitting here with years of sobriety and you don't feel that way about your life, why keep coming back? Keep coming back. Pockets of enthusiasm will turn into quicksand, martyr, mucks, but you just throw a plank over it and walk over it and say you worked a step and feel good about yourself if you want to, you know, or give your sponsor credit, or even God for that matter, you know. You really didn't care, but you can get through things. It's hard to believe. It's hard to believe that we can come from where we came and enjoy life. It's a process. I didn't get in Alcoholics Anonymous because I just woke up one day and said, "I think I'll go join a group of people that say, we care." I drank myself into Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad's an alcoholic. His dad was an alcoholic. His dad was an alcoholic. And his dad was an alcoholic. And that's as far as I wanted to check. I don't say that as some kind of a braggadero. By the time it got down to me, I was the family's best worst example, and I really had a process of alcoholism. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but when I had my first drink, an alcoholic was born, and I loved alcohol. I had a romance with alcohol. For those of you that are hope to die dope fiends, there's stories in the big book for you. You can fit here also. I'm not a specialist. I'm a pig. The only thing I've never had was a pap smear. But I'm a blackout drinker, and I drank with people who'd give you one, so, you know. I did it all. I did it all. I didn't wonder what this will do. I just moved on. When something balked or I had a lull in my melody, why I just took something else and went somewhere else and did something else. And I'm one of those guys that likes a deal. I like the deal. I don't care if it's 50 cents or 50 million. I like the deal. I want the deal. If this wasn't the best deal tonight, I wouldn't be here. That's the deal. You betcha. I love the deal, man. There's people who wait for things to happen. There's people who watch things happen. There's people who make things happen. And I'm one of those guys that makes things happen. I've always liked to make things happen. I made a lot of jail doors open and close. I was born in Texas, and so that you'll know the difference between a Texas tale and a fairy tale starts out once upon a time, and a Texas tale starts out, you're probably not going to believe this shit, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Woo! Yeah! Being from Texas don't make you an alcoholic. It's a disease of its own. Yeah. But I grew up in the Texas-Oklahoma panhandle, where the men are men and the sheep are unscared. And the Baptists bought all the liquor license, so there was, they had moonshine, white lightning, and home brew. And the only things that was floating in that stuff was dead flies and a couple of crickets. You know, I didn't have any funny little umbrellas or tea leaves or anything. And when you drank that stuff, you went somewhere and never moved. And it's an acquired taste. You could see sound and hear color when you drank that. And I got in trouble when I was 12 years old, and they locked me up for hit and run and leaving the scene of the accident with bodily injury. I was 12 years old. I grew up in a farming community, and I could drive a car when I was 12. I got a farming permit, and I had my own car when I was 12. I grew up in a family of educated people, good people, God-fearing people, but a lot of alcoalism. They were upper-middle-class people, hard-working people, had money and farmland, and my father was a lawyer, went to school and became a lawyer. I never resented the fact my old man was a lawyer. I kept him on retainer for years. I just ended up in the drunk tank with him, and I said, you know, how are you going to represent me? You're in jail with me, you know. And I don't worry, I know the judge. Yeah, I knew I had to get a new lawyer, but he told me one time, he said, the only time I ever talk to you, I'm interrogating you. And that's how we get to know each other. But I drank with my father, and we were drinking buddies, And, of course, you know, it just got worse and worse and worse. They locked me up when I was 12 and a half years old in a junior reformatory and started some of my abandonment issues. I didn't realize that's what was going on, but looking back, I got out of there when I was 16 and a half years old, and I met and married a young lady whose father had a lot of money. And I'm a quick study at that. You know, it doesn't take me long to get the message. And I borrowed a car in Fort Worth, Texas, that had some burlap bags in the trunk, and there were some outside issues in those burlap bags. And I had another hit and run with bodily injury and leaving the scene of the accident, and I got busted in Fort Worth, Texas, and my father-in-law come to see me when I was in jail, and he said, I have a lot of money. And I thought, gee, that's great. He said, the reason I have a lot of money is because I don't make bad investments, and you're a bad investment. And so they annulled me, and some more of my abandonment issues stacked up. And I, as a result of that, I had to go to Huntsville Penitentiary and spend a little time down there. And that was before they had anger management and, you know, how to manage your meds and things like that. And pretty much just do your time. And I did my time, and I got out and got $100 in an old suit and a jug of whiskey and got on a train and headed for home and kind of went back over my life, did my first fourth step. I didn't realize it, but I look back on my life. And I, you know, I need to stay out of them honky-tonk bars. I need to stay away from them sick women and stay out of them fast cars and stay away from them guys that raise hell all the time. And the train pulled into the train station in Amarillo, Texas. I got off. My two very best friends, Oily and Goose, were waiting there in an old pickup that had some fruit jars full of moonshine and a jar full of bennies. And they'd been sitting there a couple of days and running the battery down, listening to Wolfman Jack from Del Rio, Texas. And I stumbled off of there, and we got a push start. And I did my first fifth step, and I told Oily and Goose, you know what, I need to quit hanging around with guys like you. And they said, yeah, you need to quit hanging around with us. And I said, I need to stay out of them honky-tonks, and I need to, you know, I got to stay out of trouble. And for about an hour, they listened, and they agreed with me, and I agreed with them, and I agreed with me, and we pulled up in front of this dance down on Wolf Creek, and it was midnight, and I went in, and the band was taking intermission. I grabbed a Coke bottle and rolled it up and bumped the stage and said, let the meanest sucker in the house bring that back. And I'm going to tell you, a bunch of hairy-legged old boys come off the wall real quick right there. And they headed down there, and I punched the first guy leading the charge, and then I ducked into the woman's restroom. I may be sick, but I'm not stupid. As I went in the woman's restroom, there was a lady standing there, and I said, tell me when the fight's over. And she said, okay, and I ran in the woman's restroom. And pretty soon she stuck her head in and said, you can come out now. I went out, the band was playing, and she was handy, and I'm a quick study. I asked her to dance. And that was 47 years ago, baby. Yeah. We're still dancing. She finished that fight that I started. Yeah. That's a keeper. I said, where you been? I haven't seen you around. She said, where you been? I haven't seen you around. And she said, I just got out of an unwed mother's home. I said, I just got out of prison. Hey, let's go together and give two people a break. We dated for 2 weeks, and the people in that community nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. It was so brutally painful that it had to be love. Couldn't be anything else. It was terribly violent. Both of us are very, extremely violent, violent people. And I don't mean, temper tantrums. We just beat the living tar out of each other and called it foreplay. Passion. Really, I mean, people would, we'd be fighting and yelling and screaming, and well-meaning people would, you know, come in, a third party would come into our fight, and we'd just beat the living tar out of them, then go to bed and make mad passionate love. It was just great. Occasionally, we invite somebody in. May have to beat the hell out of Chris tonight. So, and I, you know, people say, how can you be together for 47 years? Good sex. I'm telling you, good sex. That's it. No therapist. We don't need any. I want to thank some of the ladies from AA that have helped her through a couple of dark spots there. Yes. I'm telling you, we're just like the county fair. We're bigger and better every year. Really. I'm very grateful. I'm very, very grateful. And There's been times we've had to pray for passion, but it'll come. But we went together for a little while, and then she was pregnant, and she said I was the father, and I don't remember that. I must have been crossing over the invisible line. But I tried to do the right thing, and we got married. And, you know, there's times in my life I try to do the right thing, and I would try to be a father and a husband. You know, I don't know how to be responsible. I was sober a long time when it dawned on me, being responsible, responsibility is the ability to respond. I didn't know that, you know. And, you know, I just gone all the time and all kinds of crazy stuff. And she had a little girl, and I couldn't be a father. I couldn't be. It's hard to be a disciplinarian from a distance, and I'd get in trouble, and we'd have to pull up and leave. And we ended up in California because my friend Lion Shorty told me I could get a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach. Oh, ye of little faith. Anyway, you know, it's a long story. I left Oklahoma City. It took me 30 days to get to L.A. Most people can do it in 3, you know. But I was lost a lot. I was lost a lot. And I finally got to California, and I got a drunken uncle, and he got me a place to live and moved into this house. There was a bunch of hippies living next door to me, taking LSD, taking their clothes off, laying in the front yard naked, watching the sun come up and go down. I never seen anything like that before. Kind of interesting bunch. I had to leave Oily and Goose back in Texas, so I went next door and met Doc and the professor. I did it. I dropped some acid and went to see 2001. Yeah. And, I know that dates me, but, you know. I said, be careful, you'll have a bad trip. It ain't going to be a good trip unless it's a bad trip. What do you mean, you know? Oh. Anyway, I got in trouble. And sometime in 1970, I stood in front of a judge. They let me out of jail. And I'd been in a fight. And I was doing real good, except this guy's brother hit me upside the head with a crescent wrench. And it almost tore my ear off. And so they took me in, the cops came, and they took me to a hospital and a jail ward and sewed my ear back on. I had this big old blood-soaked ear muff on, and I had long hair and a long beard, and heavy underwear on, or any socks on, and a whole pair of cut-off Levi's and a wife-beater T-shirt, and bleeding all over. And I was traveling pretty light, really. I didn't have any identification or anything, you know. So they take me in front of the judge, and the judge says, you know, here you are again. We're going to sentence you to A&A. And so they had this guy, you know, I didn't know what A&A was. I've been doing B&B myself. So I just, you know, but I owed some people in jail money. So I didn't want to go there. So they had this AA guy come and get me, and he took me home and said he'd come back and get me and take me to an A&A meeting, or showed me where one was. And meantime, she'd gone to see a new lawyer, and he's told her I should go to A&A. So she came home with a new idea. You should go to A&A. And I said, well, I thought I'd come to that, so I didn't tell her I had a court card. And they have a meeting tonight. It starts at 8:30, and it's over at 10. Let me give you this picture. My house was painted 4 different colors because I lost interest easy. I had good intentions, but I lost interest easy. Our family wagon was a Pinto, a baby poop brown Pinto that went down a road crooked, had a hole in the muffler and no reverse. And the window on the driver's side was half down, and she wore these hairdos with a can and a half of spray net in it that always leaned out the window. The inside of we had a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that had shrunk with the disease of alcoholism, chewed all the hair off his body everywhere his mouth had reached. All the hair was stuck to the inside of the windows of the Pinto, and the cat had a permanent puff tail, and the kid looked like a wounded animal, and I got my blood-soaked ear muff on, and she comes in and peels me off the couch and says, we're going to AA. Yeah, okay. I get in the Pinto. And we had to drive. You had to drive up through the hippie's yard and be sure not run over anybody, and park. And then because there's no reverse in the Pinto, we pulled down and pulled out in front of a church, something like tonight. You know, you could look in and see all the people in there. I remember thinking, well, if my friends see me going in here, they'll never have anything to do with me again. That's low-bottom snobbery, baby. I don't care where you're coming from. When you're coming from our house like that and come over, I don't want anybody to see me doing anything. And she sensed my approach avoidance, and she stuck that knife in my face, and she said, what time's the meeting over? And I said, I think it's over at 10. Stuck that knife in my face. She said, I'm going to tell you something, Ace. If your ass comes out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you. I had some reference points there. I went to A&A. I sat in there and counted the squares and the ceiling and the light bulbs that were out and the hairs in the old timer's ears. And she waited outside in the Pinto. Nobody said, you need a sponsor. She was in the Pinto. Need a book? No, she's in the Pinto. There was an Al-Anon meeting next door, but there wasn't anything wrong with her. And so I went to my first A&A meeting, you know, and went home and sat in the house for all, you know, till the next week, whenever the AA meeting. Well, I didn't know there was any other AA. Nobody came up and said, hi, how are you? We're welcome to AA. We got a, you know, I'm your sponsor. We'll go through the book. They just looked at me and said, he's not going to make it. He ain't done. And I wasn't. And I know that, you know, there's two kinds of people who come to AA. People come to change the conditions in their life, and some people come to change their life. And I just came to change the conditions in my life. That's all. And the conditions change. Yeah. And I beat the deal down at the courthouse, and she let me go by myself, and I got drunk. Yeah. And I stayed drunk for about the next 4 to 6 years. I don't remember. I wasn't keeping track. Went to AA drunk. Went to AA sober and left at coffee break and got drunk. Come out of a blackout in an AA meeting. That's scary. I'd have left, but I didn't know who brought me. You know. I tell you, there's nothing worse than having, you know, belly full of booze and a head full of AA. You know you're a loser. You know it. You just know you're through. It don't make any difference. People look at you with that look, and it's just like, I know. Now, I tell you what, all those things, you know, humiliation, I know shame. I know shame. I know what it's like to stand in my house in the kitchen, look down a hallway, a 9-year-old girl stands at the end of that hallway, and she got her chin on her chest and her hair's in her face like a wounded animal, and I'm standing there in the kitchen with a bottle of vodka, 6 o'clock in the morning, and I turn around and take a drink out of that bottle, and when I look back, she's gone. She didn't say, Daddy, come play with me. She didn't say anything. I didn't take that drink because I was ashamed of what was going on. I'd move way past shame. I'll go way past shame. I know what it's like to stand in my bathroom and look at me in the mirror, and I'm looking at me, and I see something in there in that mirror, and there's something screaming inside of me. There's something as loud as any voice I've ever heard or any screech I ever... What's going on? And I can't stop it. There's nothing coming out of my mouth. It's just absolutely unbearable, and yet I cannot stop it. And what I'm putting in me had better work. You see, what I'm putting in me, it better work, because if it don't work, I don't know what I'm going to do, because now... Now I'm putting this in me, so now it'll be all right. And I look in that mirror, and there's a 9-year-old girl looking through the hole in the door in that bathroom where I probably stuck my foot. And she didn't say, Daddy, come play with me. She didn't say, Daddy, please don't beat me and Molly. She was gone. And something inside of me. I believe I'm the kind of an alcoholic. I'm a drunk with a conscience, and periodically I would see glimpses of me, the true me. And I believe that inside of me, I didn't want to live that way. I didn't want to be that way. I didn't know how to stop. I did not understand the phenomena of craving. You see, I'm the kind of an alcoholic that has the phenomena of craving. The phenomena of craving is very, very powerful in me. I'm sober 31 years, and the animal's in the cage, and the door's not locked. And I never forget that. And I know today, looking back on my life, that that phenomena of craving, even though I could not understand it, it bewildered me. It terrified me. It destroyed the souls of the people around me who loved and trusted and believed in a God that couldn't stop this monster. And I know today that I understand that I am the kind of an alcoholic that has the phenomena of craving, and I cannot fire that up again or I'm truly lost. And one time, some people captured me. They captured me. And I don't know, I didn't pray, God help me and I'll do anything. I was just screeching up and down the mainstream of life. I owed some money. And these guys said, I tell you what, if you'll drive this vehicle to San Francisco, we'll, take a little off your debt. And so I did some coke and some Jack Daniels and got in this vehicle and I started for San Francisco. And I got up about Santa Maria and I got another bottle of whiskey and I had an alcoholic idea. I think I'll steal what's in this vehicle. Had about $250,000 worth of coke. So I hung a right and went to Bakersfield over by Bakersfield and hit $250,000 worth of cocaine. And went over to Taft, California and got a room for $50 a year and drank the rest of the alcohol and forgot where I hid the coke. I mean, that's how I know I'm an alcoholic and not a dope fiend, see? So here I am over there sometime in December of 1975, and I knew I was in a lot of trouble. And I finally crawled out of there in May and came back home one more time, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And some people from Alcoholics Anonymous came. 12-step call was made on me. And they put me in a detox. Detox. Nothing. How about some Valium and hard candy or something? Nah. Nothing. Eat a banana. You need potassium. Eat a banana. And they locked me up. And I was in there for a couple of months. And I had to detox. And it was, man, if I don't ever... Oh, I've had some bad days sober, baby, but I don't ever want to detox again. Thank you very much. I never forgot that. It's just, oh, gee, I'd take 3 steps and laugh and 3 steps and cry, and I'd see pictures of my life, and these people wanted to kill me, and I couldn't remember where that damn coke was. 52 days sober, I remember where the coke... Ah, hey! I didn't ask my sponsor to go with me or get a newcomer. I made a phone call and said, I know where the stuff is, and he'll meet me and we'll get it back. And I did step 9 real quick. I tell that for a couple of reasons. First of all, that part in the big book where it says your enemies will welcome you, be careful of that, okay? And I had a wife and a daughter, and I didn't know... You know what to do? I got a sponsor. And because they told me I had to have one, I tried to work the steps. And, I did an immoral inventory and a fearful inventory and a sex inventory and went to Alaska and shared it with an Eskimo. They do some strange stuff up there on the tundra, let me tell you. I was just sober. And I owed all this money. I had to pay this money back, and I had to get money to pay the money back. And I bought this house for $20,000. I owed $140 on it, and I had court cases in 3 or 4 different counties. I'd sit in meetings, and I'd just scoot my chair around. It was just like there was energy, and just I'd be over here, and then I'd be over there, and I'd wake up in the middle of the night, just. What am I going to do? And I'd pray, and I'd work the steps, and I'd write. I'd get angry, and I'd write. And I'd hand it to them. Looked like I wrote with a Hershey bar, They said, we love you. And I was just insane. I wake up in the morning, Saturdays were bad, and I'd wake up Saturday and who am I and where am I going? I need to go to a meeting. I'm for Texas, so I'd put on my Levi's, my cowboy boots, and cowboy hat, and get in front of the mirror and do a couple of howdy duties. And I'd go out, and she'd take a dive for the phone and call her sponsor. And I'd kiss her goodbye, go out and get my pickup and head for the meeting. I'd get about halfway to the meeting. I think, no, I'm not a cowboy today. I'd turn around, and I'd come back, and I'm a biker today. So I'd go in, and I'd take off my cowboy stuff, put on my leathers, and I'd run out. She'd be talking to her sponsor, and I'd kiss her on the cheek, and I'd leave, and I'd get about a block from the meeting. I'd think, no. I'd turn around, I'd come back, and I'd put on my suit, and I'd go kiss her goodbye, and I'd get down there about halfway to the meeting. I'd think, no. And I'd turn around, I'd come back, take my suit off, and put on sweats, and jog to the meeting. That's why newcomers are tired when they get to meetings. Her sponsor asked her one time, how many people live in that house? She said, he's got it down to 4. Because when I got here, I could pose for a family portrait by myself. I don't know if I was frank or earnest or walking or riding a bicycle. I go to them question answer meetings. I put in there, who am I and where am I going? And my sponsor would get that out and he'd say, you're an alcoholic, you're going to a meeting. Oh, okay. They made me secretary of a meeting, and and people would hug me, and especially men would hug me, and I'd have that tingling sensation and question my sexuality. I was standing in this meeting, I was dying inside. I'm sober, and this is it. It's like, her sponsor said, what if he's as good as he's ever going to be? She said, I'll take it. And I stand in this meeting, and my sponsor would stand over in the corner. Rotten Ron would stand in the corner. He'd get newcomers, and he'd take them over there, and he'd point at me, and he'd say, if you keep drinking, you'll end up like him. I was the group's best, worst example. And I was standing there, and this guy come up to me. I'm thinking, if I could just get a banker or a lawyer or somebody, you know, with some dough, I could get I could get this thing going. It'd all work out. And this guy walks up next to me. He wasn't tall enough to be a man or short enough to be a midget. He had hair sticking out everywhere. He had a welder's hat pulled down over one ear. He painted his feet black. It looked like he had socks on. And I said, did you do that with your shorts too? And he said, yeah, I don't have to do laundry, man. I said, what do you want? He said, will you be my sponsor? And I go, oh, gee. I know I've really pissed God off. I know it. And I went over to my sponsor. I said, see that guy? I said, yeah. I said, he just asked me to be a sponsor. My sponsor said, I know. I sent him over there. He said, go over there and do exactly what he says. Now, that don't make sense to me today. See? I didn't argue with my sponsor, because if you argue with your sponsor, they get crazy and the little vein in their forehead pulsates and they yell at you. I went back over to this guy. I said, my sponsor says I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? He said, I want to go in your car. I had an AA car. Had a big Mark IV Lincoln. Had a hood longer than a whore's dream. Parked it right out in front. People say, how are you doing? Look at my car. I got an AA car. License plate said AA car. I'm doing fine. I'm dying inside, but I'm doing fine. I get to this guy. We go out the door. Two guys I know lean it against the door jamb, and Ding Dong says, hey, Keith's my new sponsor. I said, don't tell people that. Them guys said, boy, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow. I get this guy in my car, and first thing he says, how about this? And he starts telling me some sick, sick crap. And hey, I did something like that. I tell him some of my stuff. He said, dude, you're sick, man. So wait a minute. I take him home, and I pick him up. I said, why don't you brush your hair? He said, I did. Yeah, you did. Oh, all right. You change your shorts? No, I don't have to do laundry. He said, how about this? And he laid some sick crap on me. I had to lie. You can't let them one-up you. Next day, I picked him up. He said, I know you lied, man, because it's impossible to do what you said you did. I tried it. We went and heard Chuck C. talk about the
carpenter, the big book, and all the good stuff. We get out in the car, and he says, "Hey, man, we need a miracle." "Huh?" "Yeah, we need a miracle. You know, like a, we need a sign, like a burning bush or something." Well, I was thinking if I had some lighter fluid, I'd torch the hedge over there. I had a .45 automatic in the glove box, got her out, run around the chamber, stuck it upside his head. I said, "I'm going to tell you what, I'm going to count to 10, you pray. If I don't have a floating resentment, decide to pop a cap on you, you've just done step 3. We hummed away there, and I threw the old gun back in the glove box, and he jumped out of my car and ran in that meeting room where my sponsor was and rat finked on me and showed my sponsor that ring on the side of his head where I put that gun. My sponsor says, "Yeah, I know. Ain't he spiritual?" "Hey, we're both still sober." Yeah. He showed up at my front door, had a big book and a bunch of paper hanging out. I parked his old car in my driveway, all running down the driveway, and had stickers all over the AA and all that stuff. Now the neighbors know. I said, "What do you want?" He said, "I want to work the steps like you did." And I'm trying to, I know I did them. Let's see. "I'm powerless. Come on in. My life's unmanageable because you're going to be here a while. You're crazy and I'm crazy, so we're on step 3. He said, "You ain't going to put that gun." No, we're going to the kitchen, get on our knees, and do the third step prayer together. So we go in the kitchen, and he cuddled up underneath my arm. I had that feeling again. Yeah. Cat walked by and looked weird at me. He jumped up and threw a bunch of blank paper out on the table and said, "There's my fourth step." And I said, "You're not supposed to." He said, "I can't read or write. I'll talk, you write." He started talking, I started writing. A couple of things come up that I forgot to tell anybody. You know how it is. More will be revealed. And I thought, you know what? He can't read or write. We invited God in the room. I'll just put some of my stuff in his. What the heck? Hey, man, when God sends a dimster dumpster, put your trash in. We burnt that one. He jumped up and kissed me on the cheek and said, "I love you." Run out in the front yard and wave real big. Said, "I love you," and down the road he went. Standing in my front yard that day, it went from the head to the heart. It went from the head to the heart. See, up until that point in time, I'd done my fifth step with my sponsor. I'd talked to people and gone to meetings and this and that and the other. But up until that time when I gave that human being some of my precious time and got out of myself, I was like an ingrown hair. All I thought about was me. And sitting in my kitchen that day, I listened to that guy. The greatest act of love is listening. The greatest act of love is transparency. And I sit there with that guy in my kitchen that day, and he told me about how his little girl came home and crawled up in his lap and said, "Daddy, I'm glad you're sober." And she had cut one of those little flowers out of paper, and she opened it up and she said, "Daddy, I want to give you a flower that'll never die." Now, when I was drinking, if some guy had told me that, next time I'd have seen him, I would have said, "Here comes the flower guy." But me and that guy sit there at the table, and we had tears of joy. We cried them daddy tears. Tears of joy, because we both knew with our little girls, had we not been sober, what would have been going on? Gratitude. And I loved that guy. I got out of myself, and I loved that guy enough to let him into my life. And I learned that from my sponsor. See, my sponsor loved me and let me into his life. And what that taught me was that I could love another human being, and I could let them into my life. You see, up until that point, everything in my life was like looking through a straw, man. I just looked at nothing but just under the end of that straw. I had no peripheral vision. I knew nothing. I was a taker. All I thought about was me. And for some reason, prayer, the steps, spiritual experience, all of the above, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, one day I got out of myself enough to let another human being in. I love my wife. I have a relationship with my wife. I love my daughter. I have a relationship with my daughter. Those things were happening. But to love the unlovable, to be able to reach out and love another human being just because they they have the courage to open their heart, and a little bit of sunshine, just a little bit of hope, a little bit of faith. Hope is a vision beyond your present circumstances. And sitting there in my kitchen that day, both me and that guy were able to see something beyond our present circumstances. And by having a little bit of hope, we have a little bit of faith. And by having a little bit of faith, we could build a little bit of life on it. And my life has gotten better and better and better. I've had some tough times. I've had to walk back through some things. I've had to change. We've got to change. Change we must. We can't stand still. And I've had pain and sobriety that's been greater than anything I had in my drunkenness, because I had to go through it sober. I've had job changes and deaths and physical problems and various things. And I've been able to get through those things. I've been able to hold my head up. I'm grateful for the old timers that told me, don't let your circumstances rob you of your dignity. That's all you have. The only thing I have today is the dignity to stand on those streets out there and look them in the eye. See? One day sober, 1 week sober, 1 month sober. You have to build on this. Yet what it's given me is spiritual muscle. I didn't just all of a sudden get an ooey-gooey relationship with God. I got some strength, something built inside of me to be able to know the difference between right and wrong, to stand for what my principles are and my beliefs, to understand that I have values that mean something to me. Sobriety and being sober teaches us how to live and what's right and what's wrong, and we can enjoy life and be a part of it. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous and it was over. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and it began. I didn't come here to turn it off. I came here to turn it on. I want life. I want more of life. I want some more things. I want to believe in God because I believe that whatever I believe in God, He'll give me some new things. My daughter went to Italy when she was 19. She had a dream to be a model. And she worked a program and had a God in her life, and she was able to look beyond where other people feared to go, and she was able to go to Italy, to Milan, and pursue a career. And she was very successful in her career, because there is no spot where God is not. And she believed, and she did the work. In the Bible it says, good things will come to those who wait. Well, you better be working while you're waiting, slick. And I'll tell you, she worked, and she met a young man over there, a young Italian man who comes from a very good Italian family. And I told her, don't marry a foreigner. Don't go have some foreign kids and bring them back here for Mom and I to raise. And she said, see you, Dad. And she met a beautiful young man, and they went together for a long time and got married. And it was 21 years ago. And they have two children, beautiful children. And my daughter and I have a good relationship, and I'm grateful for that. It took a long time for that to mend, but I want to tell you something. You know, there's things Stephanie's talked about. Don't make a list. Don't try to cheat yourself. There's rough times. There's times when we don't agree. There's times when we get resentments, times when we get angry, times when we get afraid. That's life. But don't overlook the little things that kind of float along the wings of a prayer. Because there's things that I've come to understand. If there's nothing I can give you, let me give you this. I've been able to enjoy things that I didn't know I could enjoy. I've been able to see things that I didn't know that I wanted to see. I didn't think it had any meaning to me. I wanted to get a relationship with my daughter. I wanted to see my granddaughter, and I got to be a grandpa, And that little girl does not fear me. She knows not that these hands took another life or how they treated her mother. But I'm going to tell you something. My daughter met a young man 21 years ago, and I stayed out of their life. I would go to Italy maybe once a year, and I would go to the Bertolottos, and I would get an audience with them, and I would sit with them, and I would say, thank you for taking care of my daughter as if she were your daughter. And my daughter would translate that. Our old, old Italian family, very, very wealthy people, very, very well respected in the community. And I would thank them for loving my daughter. And they would say, don't worry. And I would leave. And I didn't meddle in their life or anything. But my son-in-law is a good man. My daughter got herself spiritually fit to be attracted to a healthy man. And she did. But I had no relationship with him. And on occasion, my daughter would tell me about this young man that she's married to, and I would hear her side of it, which isn't always good. But it's her side of it. And I tried to not listen to that. A few weeks ago, Sue and I had an opportunity to go to Italy, and they were on vacation. We got to go over there and spend time with them. And I got to stay in my son-in-law's home with his two young daughters and his wife. And I got to see my son-in-law love his kids. I got to see my son-in-law love his wife. He's a good man. I got to make a relationship with my son-in-law. I waited 21 years. 21 years to get that. See? That's not too long to wait. It's none of my business what she does. She's halfway around the world. But I have a relationship with my son-in-law today. I got to spend time with him. I was in his home. He accepted me. He trusted me. Man, that's something I never even imagined would even make any difference. But what it gelled together was I have a relationship with my son-in-law, I have a relationship with my daughter, and I have a relationship with my two grandchildren. I'm a family, man. La mia familia. Yeah. I mean, that if I drank, that wouldn't be there. We have that here tonight. I felt it when we broke bread earlier. I felt it when we prayed. I felt it when Stephanie talked about the enthusiasm. I feel it in here. If we're not a family, then stay here until you can be a part of it. Stay here till you feel safe. The greatest feeling of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was new was that I could come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and feel safe. I'm safe. By a moment, by an hour, by a lifetime, you earned it. Thank you.